We won't know until we go there. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The solar system is a busy place, with surprising numbers of small bodies, which themselves show surprising histories and characteristics, and surprising diversities. A great deal of work in studying them has been done from Earth by telescope, observing comets and asteroids from a distance, and reasoning their nature from analyzing the small amount of light they reflect. But in recent years, we've begun to send spacecraft to investigate them more closely and study them in more detail, with such successes as the Giotto probe, which first photographed a comet from close range, the Hayabusa spacecraft, which first returned samples from an asteroid, and the Rosetta mission, which is currently en route to a comet rendezvous in 2014, after which it will deploy the first-ever instrumented landing on such a cold and exotic little world. Such missions are revealing these small bodies to be stranger and more diverse than we ever imagined based on our distant studies, and teaching us that, as for many strange places in the solar system, we won't fully understand them until we go there and study them where they are. Jay Milosh has plenty of experience with just this kind of space mission. He's played an important role in the science teams for missions using the Deep Impact and Stardust spacecraft to explore multiple small bodies in the solar system. These bodies are interesting for what they can tell us about the history and evolution of the solar system, but also for their potential threat to Earth. And Dr. Milosh also has expertise in the study of impact cratering, having authored a leading book on the subject. He currently holds the position of Distinguished Professor of Earth and Atmospheric Science and Physics at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. He has authored over 150 scientific papers and holds several distinguished awards for his work. Western World's Alyssa Gilbert spoke with Dr. Milosh during a recent visit to Western University about his work on small bodies, exploration missions, impact craters, and the surprises still being revealed.
Well, thanks so much for being here with us today. So recently, you gave a talk here at Western University about your involvement with the Deep Impact missions and Stardust missions, and then the missions that have come off of those. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about those missions, what they were supposed to be doing, and how you got involved in those missions.
Okay, well, the first comet mission that I was involved with was Deep Impact. That started many years ago, in 1996, when we had the idea that we wanted to study what was inside a comet. And it occurred to us that the best way to get inside a comet was the rather blunt way of blasting a hole in it. We decided we could actually dig perhaps 30 meters into a comet by colliding a spacecraft. We originally thought maybe 500 kilograms. It was actually 300 by the time we got through the usual descopings. 300 kilograms, we hit comet Tempel 1 successfully with this spacecraft at 10 kilometers a second on July 4th, 2005. The object of the collision was to break through what at the time was believed to be a rocky crust overlying the comet that might be between 3 and perhaps 10 meters thick. And we wanted to blast through that crust and determine what was inside the comet. We expected a lot of ices, water ice, carbon dioxide ice. Our goal in doing that is that the combination of ices would tell us something about the conditions under which the comet formed, the temperature, the pressure conditions. That was of interest because we believe comets are kind kind of messengers from the past, that comets have been in a kind of a deep freeze in the outer solar system for the past 4 billion years. But we believe that by learning more about comets, we learn more about conditions under which the solar system formed. Comets, we think, are the most ancient materials in the solar system. And by understanding comets better, we learn more about our heritage of the formation of the solar system, conditions in our solar system 4.5 billion years ago. And so we undertook this mission. We succeeded in impacting the comet. We found out, first of all, that there, in fact, is no thick rocky layer around the comet, that comets shed their material kind of like a snake peeling its skin. It's constantly losing the surface material. We didn't know that before we did the experiment.
Right. Interestingly, before you did this, it was thought that as the comet kind of released its volatiles, that it would leave this kind of dirty snowball crust on the top layer. And so the idea of kind of hitting into the comet would be to take off that top layer, and then you kind of expect to see this huge outgassing. Is that correct?
That's right. We expected that when we blasted through the thick layer that we thought was there, we would reveal the interior ices, and we'd really turn the comet on. There were predictions at the time we'd turn this rather dim comet into an object you could see in the daytime with your naked eye. That was a little extreme. We weren't the ones that made that prediction, but some of the amateurs and very responsible people thought that there was a possibility we'd make a very bright, very spectacular object out of this otherwise humdrum comet. The fact that that didn't happen told us something important, and that is that there wasn't, this layer hiding more volatile materials, and that comets, in fact, don't have huge masses of ice hidden inside. They're a mixture, and we learned by the experiment, a mixture of a very fine powder of particles of ice and particles of dust, as well as organic materials, inorganically produced tars of carbon and hydrogen, that all these were mixed rather intimately throughout the interior of a comet. So we were surprised by what we found, but that's good in exploration. If we knew what was going to happen, we wouldn't have done it in the first place.
So now this whole idea that it's kind of homogeneous almost, well, not homogeneous, but it doesn't have this thick crust on it. How does that explain the dying of comets that we associate with comets, and they're losing their volatiles as they go around, and the main belt comets and that kind of connection?
It tells us that comets lose their mass by sort of fizzling away from the outside. There isn't any sort of spectacular end game where they burst apart and reveal all their volatiles, although we do observe that when comets end their lives, they usually do it by breaking into a large number of pieces and essentially disappearing. In fact, it wasn't the target of deep impact, Tempel 1, but it was another comet that we had planned to go to for our final flyby of a comet. We expected to go to another comet that didn't show, evidently had died somewhere out there in the darkness of the outer solar system. We ended up going to Hartley 2 because it actually showed and was on schedule and we could get to it. And okay. So we chose Hartley 2 as our secondary target because our planned secondary target didn't actually reappear. That does happen with comets for reasons that we don't entirely understand, but we're getting much more insight into how comets live and die in the outer solar system by our close investigations of comets in person. We can't actually observe comets, from the Earth. For example, even the Hubble Space Telescope would not have been enough to reveal the details that we saw, for example, in our final encounter with Comet Hartley 2. The Hartley 2 is a very active comet. We think on its last legs, it's been reduced in size to only a tiny fraction of its original size and is spending its last volatiles. But again, it doesn't seem to have a surface crust. We didn't actually hit that. We already expended our impactor. But we could see blocks of material being lofted off the surface by ices evaporating when we flew by it.
Which was quite different to Tempel 1, right? With Tempel 1, it was almost this powder.
That's right. Tempel 1 seemed to be composed of a fine fine powder without any blocks. Mm-hmm. Whereas at Hartley, almost everything's to be organized in terms of chunks and blocks, which we actually observed in the act of coming off the surface and expanding into space, breaking up as they expanded further into space. We passed by it about 180 kilometers away. At that stage, we didn't encounter any big blocks, which fortunately for the spacecraft, which we would not have survived such an encounter. But right. we did fly through swarms of small particles that we recorded as impacts on the skin of the spacecraft. And we made, in fact, some recordings of that. You could hear sort of staccato, almost like machine gun fire, as we ran through the field of solid dust particles left behind as the bigger chunks lofted off the surface were disintegrating.
Basically, these two comets are very different from each other, and I'm sure every other comet is different in some way, right? So it's almost to the point where we're knowing more but knowing less at the same time, right? That cross-section where we're finding out all this information, and it's kind of fighting the information that were theories, I guess, we had before.
Well, to some extent that's true, although surface of comet Tempel 1, which we impacted, looks different than the comets coming into the solar system for the first time, the so-called long-period comets, which we could not get to with any spacecraft. What we found out by looking at the spectrum of light reflected from the materials that we dug out by our impact is that the stuff we dug out actually, in its light reflectance properties, looks very much like the long-period comets. That was also kind of a surprise. The light reflected off the nucleus of an evolved comet like Tempel 1 is different than the long-period comets that come in, like Hale-Bopp, coming into the solar system for the first time. Once we dug material out of the interior of Tempel 1, it looks rather similar to that. So yes, comets in our experience, our experience now with three of them, seem to be quite different on the surface, but underneath, when we actually dug material out, it looked like the pristine comets that we see coming from the outer solar system. So there are differences, and then there are deep similarities as well. It's not a simple story, but then, you know, real life isn't always simple. We've learned a great deal more about these objects that were originally thought to be so pristine. We're finding they're maybe not as pristine as it was originally believed. These comets have their own geologic histories, their own individual geologic stories. Things in the solar system aren't all that simple as we might have been led to believe by speculative arguments.
So speaking of geological histories, that's really kind of your end of things, right? You're not typically a cometary scientist, but you're more involved in impact cratering and geological processes.
Yeah, that's correct. I got into comet science very late in my career, and only because of my interest in impacts. And
okay.
The Deep Impact mission, which involved an impact onto a comet, was something that I just had to be part of because of my interest in impact craters.
So I know I can talk comets all day, but I know my colleagues here would want to string me up if I didn't talk to you about impact cratering and all that wonderful stuff. So maybe we can switch gears a bit and you can talk about that area of research and what are the new things that you're working on in those types of areas.
Well, the study of impact craters started out. Actually, in fact, Canada is one of the first nations that recognized the importance of impact craters, and it was in the 1950s that a man named Beals had the vision to start a research program in studying impact craters. And Canada is blessed with many beautiful impact structures. Or the importance of impact was probably first recognized in Canada and by Canadian geologists, and that tradition continues to this day. There's a lot of interest in impacts in Canadian universities, both here at Western as well as at other campuses around the country. The recognition of the importance of impact is spread now to the other planets in the solar system. There are impact craters on just about every other object in the solar system that's been observed. And we now recognize that cratering is probably the most important geologic process, certainly the most common throughout the solar system. We now believe that the dinosaurs died as a result of a big impact 65 million years ago, and that our own moon was created by a still bigger impact back about 4.5 billion years ago when a Mars-sized body ran into the proto-Earth. So the study of the physics of the impact process and the results of impacts is actually turned out to be a study of some of the most fundamental processes in our solar system, and in fact in other solar systems, because we have recently discovered another solar system with a not very euphonious name of HD172555 that seems to have suffered a large impact of a Mercury-sized planet impacting another one probably just a few thousand years ago. So we're seeing the effect of very large impacts now in other solar systems and recognizing it plays a huge role in the origin of the planetary system in general.
Right, so you talked about the formation of the moon and the dinosaur extinction event. When I go into classrooms, those are, you know, the top two questions I get. Do you kind of have a 1 to 2 minute explanation of each of those that, you know, we can all take into the classrooms?
I guess the short story with the death of the dinosaurs is that it was the global fallout effects of the impact that probably wiped them out. The impact occurred in Yucatan, and yet the effects spread over the entire planet. The initial effect that maybe was the cause of the extinctions on land and the dinosaurs that, you know, everybody learns about was that the ejecta thrown out of the impact site rained back into the atmosphere, lost its energy very high in the atmosphere, but in re-entering the atmosphere, the heat from that impact baked the surface of the Earth, producing a condition of heat radiation from the surface rather like pretty similar to what you'd experience in a pizza oven, and that the entire surface of the Earth essentially was set inside a pizza oven for about 20 minutes after the impact.
Okay.
And that thermal radiation set wildfires over the entire globe, at least for the big-bodied animals that couldn't seek shelter. They died within, let's say, within an hour of the impact.
Really? Wow.
It started closer to the impact first, but it reached the antipode of the Earth about an hour later, and there was just no shelter from that. Only our ancestors, the little mammals living in holes in the ground, could dive into their shelters and, you know, survive for about 20 minutes of that initial burning. When they came out, they were treated to a feast of roasted dinosaur meat. The current birds living on Earth are all ancestors of water birds who nested in holes in the bank. They probably could find shelter that way. Snakes survived, amphibians survived, crocodiles survived. They all could seek shelter underwater. Turtles survived, for example. The big-bodied animals just didn't make it. And there were other effects that came later. A lot of sulfur was injected into the atmosphere that caused acid rain that washed the continents afterwards. It was a really tough few thousand years afterward.
But we should really be thankful for that time, because otherwise we probably wouldn't be
the
dominant.
If the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out, we wouldn't be here. That's right. Or we'd be here with tails and scales on our bodies. And, you know, some of the dinosaurs were getting, you know, experimenting with big brains, apparently toward the end of their evolution, but they never got the chance to complete that experiment.
So let's go back to impact cratering. So there's all these wonderful data sets coming back now from, you know, around the moon and Mercury and Mars, of course, with the reconnaissance orbiter and now Curiosity there. How is this data helping, I guess, really understand the impact process going on other planets?
The information coming back from spacecraft missions, an awful lot of it has to do with impact craters. We're learning, for example, from Mercury about very large impact craters and also from the moon. But if we come back to, you know, more human concerns, like what happened on Earth at the end of the age of the dinosaurs, just 2 weeks ago, Curiosity came on an outcrop of little spheres of basaltic composition that look for all the world like the ejected deposits of the Chicxulub impact, except much thicker. And so it's clear that something rather like the dinosaur-killing impact occurred on Mars that must have coated Mars with a thick deposit of spherules, but it was probably much bigger and probably much older. We don't know, at least yet, the age of that deposit on Mars, but it's almost certainly much older than the 65 million years that the dinosaur extinction took place. But I think one thing, if there's any takeaway, one single takeaway message, is that impacts have occurred everywhere in the solar system in the past, you know, asteroid impacts. They are occurring at present, and they will occur in the future. So we are living with this constant hazard of asteroid impacts. Unlike the dinosaurs, we can do something about it. We now have telescopes that are searching the skies for asteroids that might impact the Earth. And so unlike the dinosaurs, we would probably not be wiped out by an impact because we can see it coming.
Okay.
And if we just see it coming, we may be able to do something about it.
You mean in terms of actually moving the asteroid or just preparing here on Earth for...
Well, both things. There have been many discussions about what we would do if we saw a big asteroid coming. Now, I should say that the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs was about 15 kilometers in diameter, and we already know from our telescopic surveys that there is nothing of that size threatening Earth now.
Now you mean within the next hundreds of years?
Well,
thousands
at that size, within the next few million years.
Okay, so we know orbits down to that.
We know the orbits of the big bodies down to that precision.
Okay.
The big bodies have pretty predictable orbits. But when you get down to smaller objects, that's where some uncertainties lie. We, unlike the dinosaurs, have a rather complex interconnected civilization, and a smaller impactor would probably disrupt that. Something that would not kill every human on Earth, but might kill half of us if, for example, there were global crop failures for 3 or 4 years in a row. And so it's that sort of thing that we really need to be watching out for, something that would not extinguish us, but would make it very inconvenient to, you know, have most of us starving to death.
So we're not particularly worried about the 10 to 15 kilometer range, but maybe the 1 to 2 kilometer size bodies?
That's right. A few kilometers, we think we have mapped 90% of them now, and none are threatening within the next few thousand years. That's a hazard that we probably can deal with. And if we saw something coming our way, do we deal with it by essentially civil defense, by moving people out of the way? Do we deal with it by trying to go out in space to deflect it? We have options in all those directions, and it's a matter of where the impact would be targeted, how big the object is, and so on. But that's something that there is a lot of interest in right now, and we do have some ability to protect ourselves against a hazard like that.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm sure we can talk for quite a long time, but maybe, you know, if you come back, we can do another interview about some other topic. So thank you so much for interviewing with us, and hopefully we can talk again.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
Just listened to my interview with Dr. Jay Malosh, and we covered a variety of topics ranging from the Deep Impact mission that he's involved in, impact cratering, which of course he's a big name in the field, which he covered stuff about the extinction of the dinosaurs, as well as other impacts going on in other solar systems, which he mentioned. And of course, we talked about other things like the telescope surveys of asteroids and all this wonderful stuff.
So it's one thing to study impact cratering. It's another to do applied experiments in impact cratering, and that's fun. Let's go to the comet and make one and see what happens. A lot of cratering studies are just looking at the long after effects of what's left over afterwards, and they go and make one. That's fun.
And what's interesting about it is that they found out some stuff that they didn't think that they were going to find out, that it was a little more surprising than, you know, you kind of just assume you're going to go hit it, there's going to be a crater there, and you're going to see some stuff come out, and that's it. But the stuff that they saw come out of it wasn't exactly what they thought it was going to be. And in fact, when he gave his talk at Western and he was showing the slides of where the impact was, there was not a very obvious crater there. And in fact, there's, I believe, still some discussion within the Deep Impact group of, is there actually an impact crater there where they hit it or not?
These comets are made of very unusual material, and obviously not quite the material that they thought before. I mean, it's easy to, you know, based on some very distant observations, to make a model of what this body must be like, to try and match the observations of how it outgasses and how it sets up this dust and things as it comes into the solar system. But it turns out that model was not lining up with what they found after there.
And I think comets are very, very important part of the solar system to study because of the fact that they live so far away from the sun, so they probably have all the material that's left behind from, you know, the formation of planet state. So studying those can help us understand a lot about how planets came into being and what kind of components were a part of this formation of the planets and the disk that was there before the planets were there. So doing this kind of experiments can only help us, you know, understand more of what we know.
Yeah, and that's actually the idea, right? Is, oh, comets are these pristine objects that were formed early on in the solar system, but that's actually not what they found, right? They're finding that these objects are undergoing their own geological evolution.
Yeah, they have a history of their own.
And so they might not be as pristine as we think or had thought they were previously. And so how much can they really tell us about the early solar system if they are going through this type of evolution? Now, clearly they won't be going through nearly as much evolution as, say, Earth or Mars or something like that would, but it's definitely not as pristine as we thought they were.
Yeah, so do we continue with comets? And I think there's probably value there, but maybe do we also have to consider things like comedic asteroids and stuff that maybe includes some really old material? One of the lessons, though, I think, is just that if you're going to really answer those questions, it's not enough to do telescopic observations. You have to go.
Yeah, and that's definitely a lesson learned here, right, is that we can theorize as much as we want about these types of objects, and we can make observation after observation, but we need to actually have samples of it to really know what it's like, and samples of various types of them as well. He talked about Temple 1 and Hartley and how very different they were, even though previously we thought all comets were pretty similar.
And, well, nature's always like that, right? You find a new process and you say, ah, let's explain that process. And then you find out that actually that process is really diverse. And if there's countless cometary nuclei just out in the Oort cloud just waiting to become comets, they're probably not all the same. Yeah, trying to, you know, what is the diversity between them? How has that happened? What's going on out in that dark, distant, forgotten part of the solar system?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're just getting occasionally these starry messengers.
Yeah, I really like the idea of sample missions because then if we have, let's say, like we have sample missions from asteroids and comets and different objects in the solar system, we can probably piece together the whole puzzle of how everything came into being rather than, as you said, just looking at them through telescopes sitting far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we had stardust, right, which went and caught some dust that was blown off from that.
Right.
But of course, that dust is kind of sorted by the process that blows material off and by the process of catching the material. So it's a start, but
right.
We probably need to do more.
Yeah, it's definitely not a catch-all. Just to change gears a little bit, I thought that, you know, this theme keeps cropping up when we interview these planetary scientists of this interdisciplinary nature of the study. So here he is. He's an impact cratering expert, but impact craters on Earth. But he was asked to be on the Deep Impact team, which was cometary science, because of his expertise in hitting stuff with other stuff. Here he is, someone who really didn't have a background in cometary research at all, and he got to be on this mission team, which was pretty interesting.
You're always having to cross these boundaries where you have expertise in one place that's portable to another. In the end, it's all the same nature that we're trying to investigate, right?
I think that's what attracts me most to the planetary science. It's not just one specific thing, right? It has a huge spectrum, and you can go from anywhere from being a geologist to being an astronomer and take part in the idea of planetary science, because everything matters from small things to big things, right? So that is what I love about planetary science. And I think when we let people know about these kinds of, you know, opportunities that planetary science can be from, either you're in biology or you're in physics, you can still do, you know, any spectrum between or beyond, you can still do planetary science. And that's, I think, one key thing people love about planetary science.
I mean, absolutely. When we go into classrooms, that's one thing. That's a great way to hook them, right? Is to say, okay, you might not like physics, but maybe you like biology, or maybe you like chemistry or engineering. And this is a place where you can do all those things, and you can collaborate with all different types of scientists, and you can move from one thing to another without having to get another degree or read this whole other textbook, you know? It's all in one place.
Yeah, so I saw this when I was talking to prospective undergrads coming the fall preview day and asking me how they can get into planetary science even though they don't like physics, or, you know, they don't like the math. I'm like, what about astrobiology? Or, you know, what about, like, if you are going into engineering, how about, you know, applying your engineering skills to planetary science? So it's a field that you can, you know, pick people from different disciplines and bring them all together rather than just being, oh, you're a physicist, you have to be here, you know?
There are a lot of areas of investigation where you study something and then you specialize some more and you specialize some more. And eventually you become the world expert in some microscopic slice of the knowledge pie. And this is a discipline where even if you need to have a specialized expertise, you need to be able to talk to people who have very different backgrounds. Well, we just have a student graduating here at Western who's applying in astrobiology principles of geochemistry and geomorphology. And she has to cross all of these boundaries to try and use all the tools from all the different disciplines to answer a single question about the rocks she's studying and how they interact with biology. You have to be able to cross boundaries. And so on the one hand, it's an opportunity, and on the other, it's a challenge.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster, and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and Parshati Patel. Our editor was Alyssa Gilbert, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us next week right here on astronomy.fm.